Welcome to the Canning Plus 7 podcast. To contact Kevin Williams, send him an email at canningplus7@protonmail.com. That's canningplus7@protonmail.com. Plus is spelled out when sending him an email.
But knowing about it ahead of time and planning for it and getting sort of emotionally set to be like, all right, we may hit this thing or that thing. Something's coming towards us. We're going to have adversity.
Welcome to the Canning Plus 7 podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Williams, the Blind Montana Man, podcasting to you from Billings, Montana. Brian Duff was my first guest for 2022 on the Canning Plus 7 podcast. Brian Duff is a prepper. He is from Las Vegas and Northern Michigan. He lives in Las Vegas in the winter and travels back to Michigan during the summer. Both places are where I would least expect to find preppers. It just shows that there are preppers everywhere. I should have asked him, though, what he thinks about preppers living in blue states. There are preppers out there who think you should only live in red states if you're going to be a prepper. For example, Idaho, Utah, Arizona, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Missouri, Florida, Texas, you name it. The red states, not the blue states like California or Michigan, but the red states. Now, Brian and I talked a little bit about the masks in Michigan because he was there in Michigan during the lockdown of 2020 and the mask mandates. So I asked him about Michigan and were the mask mandates enforced. And we talk about this, but he did say that they didn't enforce it so much in the rural areas of Michigan as much as they did in cities like Detroit. We also had a very interesting discussion on what is a prepper. Now, I know Suzanne Sherman and I talked about this a little bit, but Brian and I got into this a little bit deeper because there is an emotional component. You could even argue that there's a spiritual component of being a prepper. We didn't discuss the word spiritual, but we certainly discussed the word emotional. But if you want to, you could definitely say that there is a spiritual aspect to becoming a prepper. And we also discussed water, food, and fake news. I also need to bring this to your attention, because somebody is going to email me and say, oh, the application where I get my podcast said it was published today, but on your podcast, it said January 6th. Yes, let me explain that to you. The reason it said January 6th on the podcast itself is because there were technical issues beyond my control where I could not publish the podcast until today. So for you purists out there who are going to email me or send me a Facebook message saying, oh, it said it was on the 6th of January, but you published it today. Yeah, you know why now. And by the way, speaking of messaging and emailing me, how about you give me a shout out and recommend a guest or just comment on what you've heard on this podcast? Feel free to do so at canningplus7@protonmail.com. That's CANNINGPLUS, the number 7, at protonmail.com. If you want to like the page on Facebook, you can do that too by going to Canning Plus 7. That's CANNING, the plus sign, and the number 7. By the way, I would like to thank Suzanne Sherman for recommending that I interview Brian Duff for this podcast. Let's get on with the podcast. I am confident that you will enjoy this podcast with Brian Duff, the first Canning Plus 7 podcast of 2022. Let's get started. It is the Canning Plus 7 podcast. I'm Kevin Williams, podcasting to you from Billings, Montana. That is Kevin Williams, the Blind Montana Man. I know it's been a while since we've done a podcast with the holidays and all, but we're back into the groove of things. And I want to thank Suzanne Sherman for telling me about this particular guest, Brian Duff, who is a prepper. His website is mindforsurvival.com. That's mind and then the number 4, survival.com. Now, Brian, how did you end up in Vegas? That's the last place where I would think a prepper would be.
I came out here a few years ago. I was running the training center for North American Rescue's medical training out here. And so I came out here and I in the wintertime or in the I stay out here in the wintertime, and in the summertime I head up to northern Michigan and hang out up there, and just don't want to do the snow in the winter, so I come back down here.
Okay, and how do preppers get treated in northern Michigan? I know Michigan's a blue state. How do you get treated over there?
Oh, I think it's pretty good. I mean, you know, they're preppers everywhere, and you know, we kind of I think we attract one another a little bit. So yeah, it's not bad.
Well, let me ask you this really quick. I want to get on to prepping, but I actually talked to a person in Michigan just to give people an idea. Michigan is definitely a blue state. But then I talked to a guy who lived near the Michigan-Iowa border, and he was telling me that during the COVID lockdown, that particular area where it borders Iowa was regulated the least in Michigan. In other words, yeah, they had the mask mandates, but he could walk into stores, he could walk into restaurants without his mask. Nobody cared. As a matter of fact, most people in that area of Michigan did not have masks on. Am I correct?
I was up in like northern Michigan, so I don't know what was going on down south, but I think it's, you know, I think when you get out of the big cities, you get to more rural areas and all that, you know, you have that kind of that shift. So yeah. I think it's from place to place really over there.
Yeah. So would you say, I don't want to get too off topic because we really got to talk about prepping, but northern Michigan, where is northern Michigan?
So you have the Upper Peninsula, which was up north of Lake Michigan. Then when Michigan runs up the west coast of Michigan is on Lake Michigan. So probably about 2/3 of the way up Michigan towards the top of the state before you cross over into upper Michigan. I think parts of Michigan are higher than like several parts of Canada. So it's pretty far.
So are you near
pretty
Detroit far up there. Then?
Probably about 4 hours northwest of Detroit, maybe five.
Okay. So where you were, apparently the mask issue and the lockdowns weren't, I mean, a big deal. I mean, it was, but apparently they didn't enforce it too much where you were either.
Yeah, I kind of think it was more of people did what they were comfortable with, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there were signs up and, you know, for wearing it in the supermarkets and different places, but you'd see people without them, some people with them. And so, yeah, I think it was a little bit more 50, independent.
50 maybe?
Yeah, I think at the height of when everybody was early on and everybody was trying to figure out what's going on with this, you know, I think it was probably higher than 50-50. And then as people became, you know, just more comfortable with it and not, you know, not comfortable with doing the mask thing anymore. I think more and more people slowly it went down. And so when I left there a month or two ago, sometimes you'd see half the people in the store wearing them, sometimes not, sometimes a little more. I think it was just kind of depend on what's going on.
All right. Well, we're going to get our minds off of lockdowns and we're going to talk about prepping, although prepping could certainly tie into this, couldn't it?
Sure.
How did you get into prepping and what made you start to be a prepper? We'll start there first.
I think I've been a lifelong prepper. I was, when I was on swim team in high school, I think my ninth grade year, I got the Mr. Prepared Award. Like everybody's like, you always have two pairs of goggles, two pairs of, you know, Speedos and all this different stuff. So I've kind of always been into it. My buddy's dad, he was a World War II Marine. He kind of got me hooked on preparedness and just, you know, looking at the government differently and, you know, kind of being more critically thinking about what's going on around us from the get-go. And that started, I mean, I started off as soon as I graduated from high school, I became an EMT, became a paramedic, firefighter, was in the military and kind of just went down that sort of a career path that had skills and the mindset that just kind of crossed over preparedness in a lot of places.
Now, what do you do for a living now?
I'm retired now. I do my podcast and I do my Mind for Survival. And other than that, I'm done with. I'm one of the people who left the workforce, and I don't plan on going back. So.
You sound awfully young.
53.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, I'm really impressed with your website. We're going to talk about your website. You've got a lot of information. It's like a study guide on how to be a prepper.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to talk about this. First of all, let's talk about what is a prepper. Now, Suzanne Sherman and I talked a lot about prepping in terms of, you know, being a prepper doesn't mean that you're a hoarder. Being a prepper means that you can buy, let's say, 5 or 6 cans of canned chicken, and then you go to the store and buy 5 or 6 cans more or 2 or 3 cans more. You buy Maybe you go to Costco and you buy the 5 toothpaste tubes in a box, and then you buy another one. Then you buy another one when you go to Costco. So you keep stocking up, but there's more to prepping. And I didn't even think about this. One of your articles that you wrote on your website, mindforsurvival.com, you wrote, "What is a prepper?" And you talked about the emotional state. You know, prepping is not just preparing for the apocalypse. It's not just buying beans, bullets, and I would add rice and noodles.
Sure.
It's about emotional states. And you talked about one of the things that preppers should do is prepare themselves for when times get rough. And maybe that prepper is the one that all the loved ones can rely on, because they didn't just prepare physically. They prepared emotionally, spiritually. Mm-hmm. And you also, I want to get into this a little bit. You attributed Shelby Gallagher and Glenn Tate.
Right.
And I just listened to that podcast. One of them, I haven't listened to all. There's a lot, but I'm actually in the midst of listening to the one where Glenn caught cancer. My gosh.
They had a rough year.
Shelby is a rock. Do you want to elaborate on what I just said about prepping and all?
Yeah. So I think prepping is kind of an extension over preparedness, right? I have friends that don't consider themselves preppers, but some of them have freeze dryers. They have, room full of reloading equipment. They have their firearms. Some of them even have their own ranges on their land, you know, and they live on farms where they're farming or they have big gardens. And to them, it's just, that's what they do. So I kind of look at, there's preparedness minded people. And then there's the side of the preparedness minded people that embrace the whole kind of prepper mentality, the prepper, you know, and enjoy that whole aspect of, I'm a prepper. Like one of my main focuses in life is preparing for really bad times. I think every prepper is a preparedness minded person, but not every preparedness minded person has to be a prepper.
Yeah.
So, and then I mentioned the emotional side of that. And I think, you know, there's an emotional side to prepping. We take it personal. We take our personal safety. Obviously, we take that personal too. And that gets back sort of to Shelby and Glenn. You know, I mean, they've been preppers for a long time. Glenn's an accomplished, they're both accomplished authors. They have their website. They have their podcast. And last year, you know, we have COVID going on, and he ends up, you know, coming down and having to fight cancer, goes through fighting cancer, and then ends up having to fight, put on a ventilator with COVID. And she's running around trying to, you know, do everything she can to make sure he gets treated as well as possible in, you know, these really difficult times. So where they were prepping for this doomsday, that you're kind of, I think people need to look at, like, you know, you can have a small micro disaster that just affects your family unit, but it's a big disaster for you and your family unit, which is what they went through last year. So I kind of think that's what we really, when we talk about the emotional side of prepping and all that, we tend to focus on these big cataclysmic things sometimes as a community, but really what you need to focus on is the more likely kind of risk metrics, risk analysis driven stuff that, like, hey, I may get really sick at some point in my life. And what does that do to my finances, do to my family and everything else?
And I would dare say that part of the reason why Shelby was prepared along with others could be the fact that they had all their food storage and water and whatever it is. Don't you think that probably helped a great deal to have Shelby and Glenn and other preppers out there emotionally, is because they had what they needed, so they weren't scrambling around at the last minute?
Well, I think there's that. I mean, there's, it's good to know that, you know, if she has to sit at the hospital all day, that, hey, we got a reserve of food, we have a stockpile of food and all that. But I think it goes past that. I think what it is you prepare for adversity enough that you understand as much as possible. I mean, if you haven't been through adversity and you plan to go through it, you know, going through it is some of the best lessons you're going to learn and how to deal with it. But knowing about it ahead of time and planning for it and getting sort of emotionally set to be like, all right, we may hit this thing or that thing. Something's coming towards us. We're going to have adversity.
Yeah.
And so I know that I'm as prepared as possible for adversity. So when you hit the adversity, it's you are in a good as position as possible emotionally to be able to hit it head on strong, to have your head about you, to not make solely emotionally based decisions, to, you know, temper it with your, you know, with your rational mind, to think about it, put perspective on it, and understand the decisions you're making, as opposed to people who get caught off guard, that then they go straight to their fight or flight and they're making decisions based solely on fight or flight, which may not truly be the best decision that they can make for themselves.
Yeah. As we talk about this, I keep thinking about my mother, who unfortunately has passed away, but I keep thinking about her. And when my dad lost his job back in 1993, I didn't realize this at the time, but we had a whole bunch of food storage. And I don't know how my mom did emotionally, because she didn't really show her emotions during that time, and for good reason. We were still growing up. My mom needed to be a positive anchor to the family, so did my dad. So we didn't really see the emotional side, but I would imagine my mom did okay because of food storage. And like you said, she was emotionally prepared. She was well grounded in her faith and all those type of things. That all helps, doesn't it?
Sure. I think anything that you do to prepare ahead of time, including, you know, like we're talking about the emotional side of it, whether, you know, whatever you do to get your faith, so that way you have confidence going into something, anything that gives you resolve to face it better. I mean, it's difficult times. You know, they don't call them difficult times because they're fun and they're nice. They're difficult times, and they test us. And so the more we can do in advance to understand what that test is that might be coming, to think it through, to be ready for it, not to fear it, but to understand, okay, when, you know, if at some point someone, you know, heaven forbid, gets cancer in the family, all right, this is what it's going to be like, you know? So yeah, that way, absolutely, when you hit it, you're ready. You're kind of, you've already run down that road. It's, you know, it's kind of goes in the line where people talk about situational awareness. Situational awareness is really the, when people talk about situational awareness and the OODA loop from Colonel John Boyd, situational awareness is the first two phases of the OODA loop: observe and orient. Do you detect what's going on in the world around you, your personal universe? And then are you able to understand what that is? So then you can go into the rest of the OODA loop, which is decide and act. You can go into that rest of the OODA loop based on good information in, based upon good parsing and interpretation of that information. And then that final make a decision and act upon it. So I think that's key for preppers, is you were really working on preparing our ability to respond to those difficult events. And that starts in that observe and orient phase early in the whole preparedness cycle and emergency cycle and everything.
Well, let me just tell you about something that happened in my personal life, and then I want to get back into prepping.
Sure.
Since we're on emotional preparedness, my mom died of cancer. And I don't know if you know this, Brian, I'm a blind person.
Okay.
And my mom died of cancer, and before she died, I kind of sensed that she wasn't going to be around long just because of her health issues and talks that I had with my oldest sister. So I started preparing, not necessarily with food storage or anything like that, but with networking, starting to ask other people for rides. This is back before I had good cane travel skills and all that. I started asking other people. My mom did not appreciate it much, but I couldn't really explain to her real well that I was trying to prepare for when she wasn't there anymore. And I got pretty good at networking. So would you consider that, maybe I wasn't prepping with food, would you consider that good emotional preparation?
Yeah, I think that's not just emotional preparation. I mean, that's physical preparation, right? You're prepping yourself like, hey, at some point mom won't be here to do this. And that has an emotional contingent to it. But it's, you know, we tend to focus on the beans, the bullets and all that stuff as preparedness, sure. But you're literally, you don't get to having the right amount of beans, the right amount of bullets and all that without proper planning. Remember, it's like that piss poor planning equals, you know, something poor performance or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but that's where you're starting off at, right? Like you're making a plan for this eventuality.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like when people prepare, I think one of the first things when people first get into preparedness that they should do is make a plan to get everybody back to their house. You know, your house is your castle. So how do you know, if you have kids and a wife or a husband and other friends that, you know, stay with you or parents that, and everybody's out and about to the four winds, something happens. How do you get a hold of them? How do you, or how do you get them all back to your house? What's the plan? Because once you have everybody at your house, now you're as safe as you can be in your environment, because that's your house. That's where all your stuff is. That's where you feel comfortable and you can lock the doors and lock the windows, hopefully, and everything like that. So how do you get back? I think people tend to look at the food and the water, and that's kind of far down. If you look at the survival pyramid or the survival rule of threes, I mean, you're talking about water. You can go 3 days, you know, theoretically without water, and you can go longer without food. Well, you need that security and stuff up front. So I think if people tend to think more about the planning early on and stuff like that, that to me, the food and the, and all the stuff we buy and the gear we get and all that, that's just kind of details that happen afterwards.
Speaking of water, let's jump into water. Maybe not physically, but topically, let's jump into water. You got some really good ideas about water storage, and I got questions, and I'm sure you've got answers, just like Radio Shack, although maybe you're the prepper. I've got questions, you've got answers. Let's talk about water storage. You've got some really interesting ideas. The first idea is to... we're talking about glass bottles here. Rinse out your glass bottle with soap and water. And this is where I was a little confused about. You rinse it out with soap and water, and then you put bleach in there, correct? Non-scented bleach with a teaspoon of bleach for every quart of water, and then you just shake it really hard and make sure it gets everywhere, and then rinse it out, and then, or pour it out, and then you can put the water in your glass container. Seal it up with the canning lid, just like a regular canning bottle that you would can peaches in or something. Put the lid on that, the ring and the lid, and then put it in a pot or the canning bath and boil it for 10 minutes. Am I correct?
Yeah. So I think the important thing when it comes down to how, like when you're storing water, is water is non-compressible. It's heavy. It takes up lots of space. So understanding if you're storing water ahead of time, how are you doing that? Finding out what works best for you. That's a lot of times in the preparedness community, people try to act, some people within the community try to act like this is, there's this one way to do things. And at the end of the day, there's different ways to sanitize your bottles. There's different ways to collect your water. Everybody has a plan, has a different thing that a different plan that should work best for them. You know, maybe you're up in Michigan where I was at and you have a well on the property. So water for me wasn't, when I'm in Michigan, wasn't a big deal. Back down here in Las Vegas, where you got Lake Mead drying up and they put all kinds of chemicals in the water, water is a big concern. So understanding what works best for your situation and going with the fact that, you know, usually the general rule of thumb is having about a gallon of water per day per person. And that's for drinking and the toilet and, you know, other things like that. And that's kind of limited in just a gallon of water a day. You know, then do you have animals? You know, I mean, heck, if you have a horse, how many gallons of water a day are you taking for your horses? What about, you know, I have a golden retriever. He drinks a lot of water. So understanding first, how much water do you need? And then planning making a water plan that reflects your needs for where you're at and scaling your preparedness. You know, are you just starting out and you're trying to get 2 weeks worth of food and water at your house, so that way, you know, you got the 2 weeks covered? Well, then, you know, you can plan on that. Some people, I have a friend, you know, he lives, or a few friends that live out in the country, and they have rain catchment systems on their house. You know, so it just depends on your needs. And then when it comes to sanitation of, you know, sanitizing your bottles and stuff, go with what works and feels best for you. Some people don't want to be anywhere around chlorine, you know, because they don't want, there's, you know, a chlorine, people believe that it affects your intestinal lining in the fact that it kills off the biome that you have down there. Just other people might use vinegar. It's whatever works best for you and you have the highest confidence in, you know how to make it work and you have the ability to make it work if something happens, is what each person should look at.
So let's talk more about this. And I think you bring up a good point that not one size fits all. But the biggest problem I've had with, well, not even water storage, I have a Yeti bottle. No, this is not an advertisement, but I have a Yeti bottle. They're very nice, very insulated. But you leave water in there for over a day, that water tastes disgusting. And that's why I wanted to ask if maybe the bleach, is that where the bleach comes in? Because you know that if you leave water in a plastic container or even a glass container or a glass can for an amount of time, it goes really bad. Is this why, I know you said it's different for everybody. Is this why you brought up the whole bleach idea? One way to make the water last long.
Yeah, I mean, you can go with different water tablets. You can use the bleach. It's just one way of sanitizing and purifying your water. And you got to be careful with all the water, right? Last thing you want to do is have water go bad on you or start drinking bad water or store bad water. So yeah, it's all part of the whole system of it.
Okay, but it seems to me like bleach or iodine probably. And once you store this water, you bring up a good point that, well, actually, before I go there, let me tell you an experience that I had as a kid. We lived in Ontario, Oregon. I don't know if that means anything to you. It's right by Idaho.
Right.
We got our water, and I think Ontario still does get its drinking water from the Snake River in Ontario. Mm-hmm. One year, we got a lot of water, and we were afraid that the Snake River might flood. Well, if that happened, uh-oh, there goes our drinking water.
Yeah.
I can almost guarantee you that in our church, my parents must have had a discussion that day of emergency preparedness. I can almost guarantee it. Because later that, we came home and had Sunday dinner and did the usual things. And at night, my parents said, we're going to fill up milk jugs. Mm-hmm. Bad idea. And you even mentioned this. I want to elaborate more on this. The milk jugs, you said avoid putting water in containers that hold milk or juice. Because let me tell you, a couple years later, we cleaned out the basement. Mm-hmm. And there was water. Oh my gosh, there were minerals on top of that jug like no other, on top of those milk jugs. You open it up, yeah. It looked awful.
It's your water is important, right? So it's not fire and forget. And that's one, I think, bad thing we do as preppers. As preppers, we accumulate things. You know, I got my water. It's good. And put it down there. And we don't go back and check it. You want to go rotate that. You know, you want to go through it. I don't like milk jugs. Milk jugs they're not made that all that great. They're not made to last. So you're putting your water supply into something that's not made to last right from the get-go. So I think if something's important enough to you that you figure you have to store a bunch of it to take up space in the event of emergency, you probably shouldn't store it. Go get some stuff where it's not going to last, right? You should go into it saying, hey, this is my emergency supply. If everything goes wrong, this is what my family's going to live on, what me and my family are going to live on. And that's a pretty serious thing. So take it seriously. Try to get it, into good bottles. You know, even 2-liter soda bottles would be better if you clean those out. I think they're made out of a little bit better plastic. I just prefer them better. And then eventually they sell water bricks that aren't too expensive that, it's like a cube of water. It's, a foot or 2 foot, depending on what size of brick you buy. There's, thinking about if the grid goes down or if your water goes out or something happens, try to fill up your bathtubs. If you have bathtubs, right? Well, like get water you. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, just the point is just make sure that you have a plan to get water and that you go with that. Again, there's a thousand ways to skin a cat. Just make sure you have a plan and it's appropriate for you and it works for you and you work your plan and know how to live your plan.
Well, let me ask you this. Had we as a family or my parents anyway, had we rinsed these milk jugs out with bleach, like you suggested on your website, non-scent of bleach or put iodine tablets, would that have worked or are the milk jugs just that bad in general?
It might have gotten you by for a little bit, but I think, again, the milk jugs are just, you don't want to store stuff in milk jugs. It's just not, it's not a good.
Yeah. Is I mean, that just it, because the plastic is thin or what's
the plastic's not good. It's, I just personally, I don't like milk storing water in milk jugs. You can't stack them. The plastic's flimsy. There's all the concerns about the different stuff in plastics and all that. I think just milk jugs are a bad way to go.
Now let's talk about commercial water, which mm-hmm. you define on your website as water bottles that are sold in the stores. We all buy water bottles because we're out and around, we're thirsty. We buy a water bottle. The water in those don't last very long either. So What if I bought a water bottle, well, commercial water, like you said on your website, opened up the bottle, put an iodine tablet in, and just left it there for a couple days? Would I get away with it, or is the plastic flimsy like those milk jugs?
No, it's water bottles seem a lot more sturdy than milk jugs. Your water in the water bottles should last quite a while. Check your expiration date and what they say on it. Water bottles waste a lot of space in their packaging, so it's not a good use of space necessarily, but I always usually keep a couple cases of water bottles on hand. They work great if you have to jump in your car and go somewhere. They're easy to grab and get a good amount of water in one spot. They stack pretty well. So I do like the cases of water. And my buddy that I do a podcast with or a YouTube channel with, he does not like using the water bottle. So again, it all comes back down to your preference.
Yeah. Cause I will tell you an experience I had with water bottles. I lived in a place where the water was less than desirable.
Right.
And so I bought tons and tons of water. I kid you not, within about, a month or so, all of the water went bad. And it's probably what you said. I never checked the expiration dates. And so I just wondered if maybe I would have put iodine. Of course, I'm not going to open up each bottle and put iodine tablets in there because there were just way too many.
But yeah, I think if you're worried about water being bad, you can always boil it. There's other things you can do. I mean, you can buy the tablets and all that, but I think trying to work with one bottle of water, especially if they're the small bottles, I think it's just, it's kind of a lot of work for what you're getting. I would at that point, maybe boil it, put in a bigger container or something like that.
Yeah. Kind of like what you suggested on your website. Right. Now, I know you said one size doesn't fit all, but what do you think is better, heating? Because you suggested too, heating the water in your oven. No, heating the bottles in your oven. And I want to ask you about that too. Heating the bottles in your oven on a cookie sheet, and then you heat it up for about 20 minutes, and then take it out at the temperature 225 degrees. That seems like that would be a highly effective way to sterilize your water. And again, I know one size doesn't fit all. It's all personal preference, but that's certainly, I mean, what would you do? Would you rather
go ahead.
Would you rather do that or boil the water? And
I would do both. No, I mean, I would try to make sure I had my containers are as sterile as possible. And then I would boil my water before putting it in those containers if I had the ability to.
So you would actually heat up your bottles in the oven and then boil it in the.
Sure,
in the
you want to try to make sure you minimize the amount of bad bacteria, the ability for the water to go bad, the ability for it to injure you, all that stuff. You want to minimize that. So take care in doing all that. You know, making sure your water sterilized as much as possible. It's purified. I mean, if you're, you mentioned it, if the river would have overflowed and you would have lost all your water, you would have had gone on a boil alert to boil water and do all that stuff. It's the same stuff that they do when we have disasters, same kind of stuff they tell us to do then.
Oh, okay. Now back to the water going bad. And I do want to get it onto other topics too. I'm just fascinated with this water thing. And I think water is actually might even be more important than storing food, because you can last 3 days without water, which is not very long.
Right.
You can actually, my understanding, go without food for 10 to 13 days. I wouldn't recommend it, but you could.
Well, people have lasted when they had the hunger strikers in Ireland back in the 80s. They had people that went 60 some days without food. So you can do it, but you're not going to be effective. You know,
I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah. Nope, not at all.
But back, because let's just say I bought a whole bunch of glass bottles from the store and just rinsed them out or washed them with soap and then just put water in it and stored it at room temperature. Would the water go bad quicker as opposed to me just putting water in the cans, boiling it, like you said, for 10 minutes, boiling it? Would the water last longer if I actually boiled it and such?
Well, I think the water, you reduce any of your bacteria and microorganisms that are in it when you boil it. So I think boiling is always the most effective way to maximize your water.
Okay. Now, when you When you if you heat your jars up in the oven, and I'd imagine you'd have to have a pretty big oven because these glass jars can get pretty big. But if you did that, I guess what do? You put the jars on the side on their sides of the cookie sheet, and then put it lay them into the cookie sheet.
Yeah, I would just put them in however they fit best in your oven and make it work.
Okay, and then when you take them out, when you take the cookie sheet out, I guess you want to cool the jars because I would imagine if you touch them, or you'd obviously get burnt, and then if you put the jars together, they break. So how would you take care of the glass jars once you took them out of the oven?
Let them cool until you can put the water, until you can handle them enough to not, you know, without touching the insides, and put your water in it if you're
okay
using jars or
yeah. Now, one thing I do want to talk about real quick are these 5-gallon water jugs. I'm sure you've seen them. You know, you can go to the grocery store, fill them up. Seems like water lasts pretty long with those. Is that because the plastic is made for heavy-duty water? Would you call that more canned or stale water, which is your favorite water to store?
Can't, I wasn't understanding your question.
Okay, so I used to have water delivered to me with 5-gallon jugs. You
sure
know what I'm...
Uh-huh.
And it seems like water can last for a very long time in those jugs. Is that because it's what you said, stale or still water?
Where they sterilize the water, they sterilize the jugs. I imagine it's because it's going through a process at the factory from the people that are making, that are filling up the water jugs and selling them, that they have to meet certain standards, and that water lasts a good, you know, I mean, that water tends to stay pretty good for a while.
Yeah, because you can even go to the grocery store and fill up that water, fill up those jugs, and it still lasts a while. But let's talk about another subject, food. You bring up something interesting here, talking about canned food, freeze-dried meats and vegetables, and then canned meat. And then you talk about be careful about the spices because... And this is an issue that I want to bring up because, you know, a lot of things have preservatives, so it's best if you can your own meat, if you can, and make recipes. But I have a question because one of the things that you mentioned on your site is you can tell food goes bad by an odor. Now, I'm just going to be really graphic here, but we're adults. We can handle this. Somebody, when I lived in Canada, Newfoundland, Canada, gave me canned moose stew, and it was in a glass bottle. And forgive me for being so descriptive, but you open up the glass bottle, it smelled like a fart, and I'm not kidding. Now, I warmed up the stew, and it tasted just fine, smelled just fine. So I don't think the odor is always going to tell you everything. It might, you know, but in a situation like this, what would you said about my situation? Because once I warmed it up in the microwave, it was fine. Is it just because the meat, it was so strong, it just kind of went, I don't know, what would you say?
I would just say that that's what canned moose stew smells like. So if you know what your canned moose stew smells like, then you should be good, right? And like you said, you did the right thing. Smelt it. Yeah, warm it up, see if it still smells, and then make a judgment call. I mean, at the end of the day, the only person that's going to suffer if you eat, or the one person that's going to guarantee to suffer if you eat bad moose stew is you. So,
yes.
Yeah, I think, again, it comes down to what everybody's comfortable with and what they think is right and not, and what they should do in that moment, I think.
With the odor, though, if I were to just have eaten it right out of the can like that, would it have been bad for me, do you think? Do you think the microwave actually helped take some of the bacteria
out? Man, I have no idea, to be honest with you.
Okay. And the last thing, oh, and you also mentioned sprouts and peanut butter. Now, I'm a fan of sprouts. My mother used to make sprouts on our salad. I didn't realize that they were sprouts. I just thought they had a real distinctive taste, and I couldn't figure out why. And I couldn't figure out why I liked them. And then a few decades later, I realized they were sprouts. Now, I've actually have been known sometimes when I was in a hurry to use sprouts as a meal replacement. May not have been the best idea because they were alfalfa sprouts. But what sprouts would you recommend? Because I noticed you said bean sprouts and micro sprouts. I don't know how.
Yeah, I think any of the microgreens that people are growing these days, whether it's alfalfa sprouts, bean sprouts, you know, they're packed well with nutrients. I think they all make a great addition to, you know, any of your meals, anything you're doing. I love sprouts. I go to the store and buy them. I just bought some today.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah.
And I have been known to use sprouts as a meal replacement if I'm in a hurry. Even the alfalfa sprouts. I don't know if that was wise, but certainly provider mints are good. And you also recommend recipes. Make recipes with your canned foods. And I think there's a big, is there probably a big debate in the prepping community right now, is freeze-dried food better than canned? Do you get all your nutrition knocked out with freeze-dried food? I don't think so.
Yeah, probably don't get it all with canned. Again, I think it's a holistic approach to how you do things. Canned food doesn't last 25 years typically, right?
No.
So if you have canned food or you buy canned food, have that part of your plan. So you eat that stuff up first, and then if the disaster or the problem keeps going on and all you get down to the point where you're on your freeze-dried food, well, it's probably better than nothing. But then again, if you freeze dry your own food, you can control what goes into it. You can be more aware of what you need, the supplementation and all that on the back end of it.
Yeah. Now let's talk about fake news. This is a good topic, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Fake news. And by the way, I'm not here to debate who is fake news and who isn't. That's not what I want to talk about, but
sure.
I have, especially over the last, I would say since about 2017, looked at websites. I don't care what the website is. WorldNet Daily, CNN. I don't care. Sometimes I've even clicked on it and found, is this really real? So let's go over the 5 steps on how to avoid fake news. I'll let you take over.
Are you talking about my article on Mind for Survival?
Yes.
All right. Let me go look at what I wrote on that. It was a while ago.
Well, I'll go ahead and I'm just pulling it up here. One of the things that you talk about is clickbait.
And right.
Clickbait is defined as the, you know, what tugs at your emotions. What is going to cause the person to click on that thing? So,
yeah. So I think one of the things people need to do, one, is understand that the way websites work a lot nowadays and the way social media works, the way the news, any of the media works really, is the websites and Google and Facebook make their money by selling information. They're advertising platforms and all that, right? So
yes.
So them, CNN, they all work off who comes and clicks on their articles, how long do they stay on the web page. All these metrics are tracked on the back end of websites that are selling stuff and all that. So the goal is to get you enraged and get you emotional. That's why you have yes. the clickbait headline. So if you see something that's a clickbait headline, it's a good chance it's they're trying to suck you in. And that it's a clickbait article that doesn't necessarily, that might be fake news, right? There might be some headline out there that is 100% spot on and it's very inflammatory or what have you. But nowadays, how many times you go to an article and you click on, you see the headline, it's like, oh, and when you get into the article, the headline has nothing to do with the article or is totally misleading. So I think that's one of the first ways, you know, when people look at things like, are they just trying to suck me into this?
Yeah, the other thing that you can do is do a Google search or DuckDuckGo or whatever search engine you like, because sometimes you might go to CNN and it'll say a violent protest occurred at this rally, but then you go to Fox News and it'll say that it was peaceful. Then you hear people that were there on a podcast or radio show and they'll say it was peaceful. And you point out, which is probably true, that the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I think that's typically the way, again, you know, Fox News has an angle they're pushing because it's about making money. Right. And right now the model for corporate media is to get people fired up, and that's how they make money. It's why Sean Hannity attracts a huge crowd. It's why Rachel Maddow attracts a huge crowd. They get people aggravated. They get people irritated. They get people emotional. So if you go look at what Sean Hannity says one day, then look at what Rachel Maddow says one day. The truth is probably somewhere in between them, right? They're usually on the extreme of whatever their tribe is. So I try to look for that, see what they're talking about, find the common points of what appear to be the common thread through both their stories. That might be true. And then making a decision based from there.
Yeah. The other thing that you mentioned is check the URL of a website. If it's something you'd never heard of, or if it has a long URL, something.rt or something.ur, some obscure name at the end or extension, that could be a red flag, correct?
Yeah, I think looking at a URL
not
of a
to
website,
say that it's always wrong, but it's good to question.
Well, you have to question because people can come in and put in a URL, some, you know, www.payyourbillnow.amazon.com and make people think, you know, they'll get some people to think it's an Amazon email address when it's not really an Amazon email address. It's some email address concocted that has the word Amazon in it. So look, and if you look at a link, if you hover over a link and it, you can see what the link is. If it doesn't look right, don't click on it. You're no one. They try to get you again. They try to get you to do stuff by fear. They try to get you to do stuff out of emotion. You don't have to click on any links. You don't have to, you know, don't assume that the clickbait headline is the truth about the article. So don't go blasting out that this is the truth. But at the same time, you don't have to click on everything that comes down the pike, you know, and just because it's saying that you have to click on it. If something tells me to click on it, like you have to click on this now, it just tells me more. Oh, don't click on that. That they're trying to get you.
Yeah. The other thing that you mentioned is people might be posting news sites who have nothing better to do. Maybe somebody in their parents' basement. Not that there's anything wrong with living in your parents' basement if you absolutely can't afford to be on your own, but something like that. There's people that have nothing to do, so they make these bogus headlines or they start posting all over social media.
Well, I think it's more than that too. Now there's bot farms that just manufacture this stuff. Like just you go on to sometimes on Twitter, there's talk that sometimes on a response on Twitter or different sites that up to 70%+ of the responses may be from bots. So it's artificial intelligence generating links, generating articles, just mass producing stuff, trying to get people to click, try to get people enraged. Sometimes that's to get you to buy something. Sometimes that's to get you to click on a CNN thing. You know, sometimes that's just to stir up trouble in the country.
And I'm going to add two more things. Trust your gut feeling, because I have occasionally read something. I'll give you an example. When Donald Trump talked about people monitoring his phone calls, I had a feeling something wasn't right here. And he just tweeted it out without an explanation. And I felt something is real fishy to the story here. And I found out, I don't want to get into this because I don't want to make this all about Donald Trump or whatever, but I found out, oh, yeah, there is more to this story. This is what happened behind the scenes. This is, yeah, I had a feeling why this was fishy because, well, I felt the government wasn't being honest with us. But, yeah, you sometimes get those and you need to pay attention to those feelings, don't you?
Yeah, that's your subconscious, man. I think we as human beings tend to think that our conscious mind drives the train. Our conscious mind doesn't drive the train. Our conscious mind is only conscious while we're awake. It's our subconscious mind that's going 24 hours a day. Our subconscious mind understands everything that's happened to us in our lives. It draws correlations between what's going on now and extrapolates it out to say, hey, there might be a problem coming down the road, or hey, maybe you shouldn't believe that. And it sends us signals. The feeling in the gut, the hair standing up on the back of your neck, depending on who you are, your body, your subconscious communicates with you in different ways. And it's up to us to stop thinking that our conscious mind can outpace our subconscious and actually go, hey, this is trying to tell me something. Maybe I should listen to it. On that, Speaking of listening, I think if you're a person in the United States today and you have any figment of your imagination that does not include that the U.S. government is listening, maybe not directly listening to your calls, but gathering every text message, every call through AT&T, whoever it is, and all your metadata, just all your stuff. If you don't think that that you are being monitored and that they're running algorithms to detect what words you're saying, whether they should flag that conversation for further review, you're probably 100% wrong. I would err on the side of caution to believe that everything you say, everything you send through email, no matter how secure we have with end-to-end encryption and all that, is all being monitored by the government.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, this is nothing new. I remember talking to a person who worked as a tech support guy for MCI back in 1999, before social media became a deal. We actually had social media back then, but it was pretty primitive.
Right.
There were social media websites like Six Degrees and others, but we didn't call it that. But anyway, before it became a big deal, I talked to a tech support guy at MCI. He helped people all around the country get their equipment installed and all kinds of things. We talked about the government reading your email. In 1999, folks, he told me the chances of the government reading your email is very high. This is way before the NSA started intensely listening to people's conversations or monitoring, like Brian said. So this is nothing new, folks.
No, not at all. No, it's been going on for a while. AT&T, my understanding, has been keeping track of every phone call that you've made. If you an AT&T customer, or you called an AT&T customer going back to the mid-80s. So it's, you know, it's out there. They have the ability to do it. So again, when it comes to the fake news stuff, obviously that's something to be on top of, but understand when we're just talking about communications, that all your communications are being listened to, watched, monitored, filtered. You know, I don't think there's somebody actually sitting there listening to Brian Duff and Kevin have a conversation. But if we say certain words, certain combinations of words, guaranteed that that's going to get a further review by another algorithm.
Yes. And I would even go a step further. What about certain people you associate with? That might be a red flag on the government's radar too, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's how they track down terrorist networks overseas, right? The first thing they do when they catch a high value target is they grab their cell phone, they download their cell phone, they run a forensic analysis of it, and they see who everybody that person called. And so I think sometimes when you talk about if they bother to get the warrants to do searches on and monitor your conversations, depending on what they got going on, I think sometimes they go three deep. So every person you talk to, then every person they talk to, they can roll up. So.
Well, Brian, we're almost at the end of this podcast. Is there anything else you want to add? Anything I'd forgotten about?
No, thank you for having me on, man. It was a good time. I appreciate it. I hope your podcast is doing well, and everybody out there, I hope everybody has a great 2022. I hope your 2022 is better than everybody's 2021s and 2020s.
Well, I have to say, my 2021 was actually better than 2020 for me.
Good.
So hopefully 2022 can be even better. I don't think we're going to go back to the pre-COVID days, but let's try to make the best of it. How about it?
Yeah, I love it, man. That's the way to be. You got to have hope, and try not, even though the times may be negative, try not to let that get you down. It skews your perspective. And so keep your eyes open and stay fresh with stuff.
Yeah, well, thanks very much, Brian. And we will talk to you all later, folks.
Thank you for listening to the Canning Plus 7 podcast. If you have a comment or suggestion, email Kevin Williams at canningplus7@protonmail.com. Remember, when emailing him, the plus is spelled out instead of the plus sign. You can also check him out on Facebook at Canning Plus 7. That's Canning Plus 7 with the plus symbol instead of the word plus on the Canning Plus 7 Facebook page.